empty space, please.
Well, thank you, and thank you everyone for attending or listening to this. So I'm going to talk about continuous formulation of the loop quantum gravity phase space. Should sit again. Yes. So this is based on the work we did with Laurent Frédal and Jonathan Zipric. So first, some motivations and the introduction. So we know that. Yeah, so slide two. Yeah, sorry. Next slide. So slide two. So we know that in canonical loop quantum gravity, we have this very nice, neat notion of a quantum Riemannian 3 geometry. And by this, we mean that if we think about a kinematical state, which is represented by a spin network on the graph gamma, there is an encoding of quantum geometry in the sense that link carry information about quanta of area, and nodes carry information about quanta of volume. And in fact, it turns out that these graphs are very important for us, because for any practical applications, we always work on a truncation of the full L2G Hilbert space, which is defined as the big sum over all these graphs. And whenever we do like any calculation, we always work on a fixed graph. And so it's a legitimate question to ask, what is the geometrical interpretation of state on a fixed graph, so once we have fixed the graph once and for all. And so there are many interpretations of these states on a fixed graph in the literature. And one of them, for example, that came out recently is the interpretation in terms of twisted geometries, which are discrete metric spaces, and in which we, so instead of seeing the spin network phase space, which is in fact T star of SU2, so which is parametrized by the holonomy is H and the flux is X, we work with a new set of variables, which are this J, Xi, N, and N tilde. And if we see this this pictorial representation of a graph with two nodes, dual to two tetrahedron, in fact, J represents the area of the two faces, so dual to the link in blue here. The angle Xi is related to the extrinsic curvature on the complex, so on the link. And N and N tilde are the two normals to the faces as seen from the two frames of the two tetrahedron. And so today, what we would like to do is to ask the question if we can see a certain parametrization of the LQG phase space, not in terms of discrete data, like this data, but in terms of continuous geometries, in terms of continuous points in the phase space of GR. And so what we're going to do is to relate the holonomy flux algebra to configurations in the phase space of continuous gravity. And we're going to see that these particular configurations are piecewise flat connections and gauge invariant electric fields. Next slide, please. So to do so, the outline, first we're going to recall some basic facts about the continuous phase space of SU2 gravity. Then we're going to talk about the discrete LQG phase space, and then about how to concretely relate the discrete LQG phase space to continuous geometries. And then we're going to talk about what we call gauge choices, and then cylindrical consistency, and then conclude. Next slide, please. So slide five. So the continuous phase space of gravity. So we know that the starting point of canonical loop quantum gravity is the formulation of first order gravity in terms of SU2 valued phase space variables. And so these conjugated variables are the Ashtekar-Barbero connection, which is defined as the sum of the Levitsch-Vita spin connection and the extrinsic curvature one form, with this coupling constant, which is the Barbero emergency parameter. And the conjugated variable is the densitized triad field, defined as this combination of little e, which is the triad field. And so these variables, they form the Poisson algebra, so with the following commutation relation. And they span a certain phase space, which we denote by this P, which is T star of H, so the cotangent bundle to the space of smooth SU2 connections. And so on this phase space, T star of A, we have a symplectic potential, which is given by this this integral form, so this trace of E wedge delta of A. Next slide, please. So slide six. So an important property is that this phase space P carries an action of the gauge group G, and this gauge group is the group of SU2 gauge transformations. And so this means that there is an infinitesimal generator of this SU2 gauge transformation. And this generator is the smeared gas constraint. So it's just a smearing of the covariant derivative of the electric field with an SU2 valued element alpha. And the infinitesimal action of this gauge transformation on the phase space variable is given by, as usual, by Poisson bracket. The Poisson bracket of the connection with this constraint gives us the covariant derivative with respect to the connection of this Lie algebra valued element. And the action on the electric field is the commutator with this Lie algebra element. And the phase space P also carries an action of diffeomorphism, which is this time generated by the diffeomorphism constraint. And so here the commutation between the phase space variable and the diffeomorphism constraint gives us the Lie derivative along a vector field on the spatial surface. Next slide, please. Now I want to introduce a sort of a tool that we're going to use later on. And this tool is that if you have a given phase space, so like the one we just introduced, P, and a group of gauge transformation with its infinitesimal generator, what we can do is what we call a symplectic reduction of the phase space with respect to this constraint. And so this we denote by this double quotient. So this double quotient of the phase space with respect to the transformation G, there are two steps, in fact. So the first step is to compute G minus 1 of 0. And this G minus 1 of 0 means, in fact, to find all the configurations or all the fields on the phase space which solve the constraint. And then we have to divide by G. So this means like we have to divide by the residual action of the gauge transformation once we are on the constraint surface. And so there is a nice theorem which ensures that once we perform this symplectic reduction, we end up again with the phase space, so symplectic manifold that carries the symplectic structure. And so we're going to be interested in this, in the symplectic structure that we obtain after one very specific symplectic reduction. Next slide. So now we're going to leave this this continuous picture to talk about the discrete L2G phase space. And so what happens in loop quantum gravity is that we do not work with the continuous phase space P, but instead we work with some phase spaces, P gamma, which are associated to embedded oriented graphs. And so this we could call the loop assumption in some sense. So we replace the continuous variables, so A of X, so the connection at the point X and the electric field at the point X, by some set of discrete data living on a fixed graph. So if we imagine now that we fix the graph once and for all, and these data, HE and XE, are associated to each edge of the graph and represent the holonomy of the connection and the flux of the electric field. And now we want to ask how we construct these data. So in other words, how to construct the holonomies and the fluxes. Next slide, please. So this is a thing that are rather standard. So to construct the holonomy of the connection, we choose an oriented edge of this graph gamma. And the holonomy is given, as usual, as the path-ordered exponential of the connection. So this defines an SU2 group element. And it's nice to work with these variables because they have a nice transformation behavior under SU2 gauge transformation. So we can see what the finite gauge transformation on the connection becomes at the level of the holonomy. And this factorizes as a discrete action at the endpoint of the edge. So we have a group element acting at the source of the edge and a group element acting at the target of the edge. So source and target at the starting point and the end point of the edge. So we also know the behavior of this holonomy under diffeomorphisms and under orientational reversal of the edge. So next slide. So now we're going to talk about the fluxes XE. And so, in fact, to define the flux of the densitas triad field, we need to choose some additional data. So we choose an edge, E, again. And then we choose a surface, Fe, which is intersecting the edge E at a certain point, U. And then we also choose a system of paths, pi E. And these paths, in fact, go from the starting point, so the vertex Fe, to any point X living in the phase. And then with this data, Fe and pi E, we can define the following flux variable. And this flux, so is the integral along the phase of the electric field E of X. But we introduce here an additional dependence on the holonomy, on the connection through its holonomy, along this path that we have introduced, pi e. So first we go from the source point to the point x on the phase, then we evaluate the electric field, and then we go back with the inverse holonomy to the starting point. And so h pi e of x has this definition. Next slide, please. So slide 10. So in fact, the main reason, the main motivation for introducing this additional dependence on the holonomy in the definition of the flux is that by doing so, we have a flux element that is clearly a gauge covariant. So if you have a gauge transformation, a finite SU2 gauge transformation on the connection and the electric field, this becomes a nice covariant property at the level of the discrete flux element. And so also we can see what happens if we compute the flux element XE for the for an edge with a reversed orientation. So we have also this nice transformation property. And so the key point here is that we see that the flux elements at the classical level are non-commuting because they carry information both about the electric field and the connection. So this is this is similar to the understanding that we have of these flux elements from twisted geometries, in which we see that they carry information about both intrinsic and extrinsic geometry. Next slide, please. So slide 11. Now we're going to see how these variables, they form the holonomy flux algebra. So now I remove all the information, so the faces and the path labeling the fluxes, and I just focus on elements defined on the edges. So just the subscript E. And in fact, for each edge, the discrete elements, so the holonomies and the fluxes, they so the holonomy lives in the group SU2 and the fluxes live in the algebra little SU2. And for each edge of the graph, gamma, these variables, they satisfy the following Poisson algebra. And so this is the Poisson structure on T star of SU2. And so with this this thing in mind, we can see that the symmetric phase space associated to a graph gamma is in fact given as the product of SU2 cotangent bundle associated to each edge. So we can say that the symmetric phase space, T gamma, is the product over each edge of SU2 cotangent bundle. And so on this symmetric phase space, again, we have a symplectic potential. And the symplectic potential is given by the sum over all the edges of these traits, so of the flux element dH, H minus 1. And so this is still classical at this level, but this is a nice picture because we see from this that, in fact, the Hilbert space H gamma of loop quantum gravity on a fixed graph is just a quantization of this discrete classical phase space. This is the classical analog of the Hilbert space H gamma of LQG on a graph. Next slide.
Actually, I have a question about this slide.
Yes.
This is Jurek from Warsaw. I mean the Poisson bracket between two fluxes.
Yes.
Okay, on the left corner, left top corner. So it's a little misleading, because if we just consider the flux variable, then this variable is not assigned to an edge. It is assigned to surface rather than edge, and then there may be many edges which intersect these two surfaces. So I understand that you make some choice, that you somehow select for each edge one surface. Is it okay? Is it correct?
Yes, exactly. So yeah, for
okay.
Each.
Where does this surface exactly intersect your edge?
I mean, it doesn't matter where really the surface intersects the edge, as long as the two surfaces that I choose for two edges don't intersect each other. So between the edge and the face, really, it doesn't matter once. Is this okay? Or? Oh, hello? Continue. So in fact, yeah, we can even, if you want, forget about slide 10 and this this definition, and think of this as T star of SU2, so the Poisson structure on the cotangent bundle of SU2, and think of this as our symmetric phase space, as our starting point. And what we want to do is relate this discrete data back to the continuous data. And so slide 12 now. So slide 12 is about gauge invariance at the level of the spinetric phase space. Similarly to what happens at the continuous level, at the discrete level in the spinetric phase space, we have also an action of the gauge group, SU2 to the V gamma, and this V gamma is the number of vertices of the graph gamma. And so this action of SU2 on the spinetric phase space is given by the action that we wrote earlier of the finite SU2 gauge transformation on the holonomies and the fluxes. And then again, we can define the gauge invariant phase space, so PG gamma, as a symplectic reduction of the spinetric phase space with respect to this group of gauge transformations, so SU2 to the V gamma. And this again is constructed by taking GV minus 1, 0, where GV is the discrete generator of the Gauss law. So here I haven't given the explicit form of this discrete Gauss law, because what we want is to identify it later on. So next slide. So slide 13. Now we see that what you have described is that once we have an embedding of the graph gamma into the spatial hypersurface, and once we have given ourselves a surface Fe and a system of paths pi e, we have described the map going from the continuous data, from the continuous phase space of gravity, to discrete data.
I was somehow disconnected when I asked this previously that question, and now so I would like to go back to that Poisson bracket of those flux operators, of those flux variables. So I'm a bit concerned that this is not actually. I mean, this idea of labeling fluxes by edges is somehow. I mean, this is something which I don't really understand well. So this is what I wanted to say. So fluxes should be defined on a classical space. Edges come from graphs. So this is what is somewhat confusing to me. This is it. Just this comment.
I understand because here, in fact, when I write X, I, E, and this E, there is more information that is not written here. It's because for each E, I have made a choice of a path and a surface, in fact. So this information here is not present, but I can think that I fixed this additional data once and for all. And then I ask the question on one edge, I have this fluxes elements and these holonomies, and what are the commutation relations, and what is the Poisson structure?
Right, but usually if this flux, if the surface intersects the edge E in the middle, then we should have two edges, because if we calculate the Poisson bracket, this flux variable with holonomy, it breaks this edge. So
if you look at the previous slide, so yeah, in fact, the spaces are chosen so that they intersect fully the edge. So for each edge that I fix, I compute this flux element by doing really this integration over a face that intersects this edge. And then I looked at the Poisson bracket for a fixed intersecting surface.
I think that this Poisson bracket of this flux with holonomy along the whole edge, it should break this edge into two pieces, and we should independently holonomy of this red part and then holonomy of this black part, and they are not combined into a single holonomy. I mean that the Poisson bracket with this flux doesn't preserve this nice holonomy along the entire edge. It breaks this holonomy into two independent pieces.
This is why we choose this additional parallel transport, so this additional holonomy in the definition of the flux. So this is on slide 10 again, on the definition of the flux.
I see. It's a curious problem.
The definition of the flux. So if we take this as our definition of the flux, then I think there is no, we have these commutation relations. They are consistent with this. Once we choose this system of path and once we choose this phase.
Oh, I see. Okay, so this is, okay, fine. So this is...
Just a tool. So we choose this and we fix it, and this is just a device to do this parallel transport and to define how to go from the source point to the point on the face on which we do the integration.
Okay, thank you. I think I'm fine. Thank you.
Okay. Yeah, sorry for that. Okay. So now we're on slide 13. So slide 13, we said that the main question we want to ask now is how to invert this map from continuous to discrete data. So if we give ourselves a bunch of discrete data, can we reconstruct continuous data from this? And at first it seems that this is going to be really complicated and impossible because we have a lot of ambiguities, in fact, because if I want to reconstruct from the fluxes and the holonomies the connection and the electric field, I have to know all the additional data that I give myself. So I have to know precisely the embedding of all the edges into the spatial hypersurface. I have to know the path and the surfaces. And so what we want to do is to find a way, in some sense, to get rid of this ambiguity by considering only a certain subset of the configurations on the phase space of continuous gravity. So this is the aim of this construction, is in some sense to get rid of these ambiguities and to see how we can, in fact, invert this map. So next slide. So slide 14. So this is the first tool that we need for this construction. So we're going to consider a cellular decomposition delta of the spatial hypersurface. And so here is a 2D analog of what we're going to do. So we have to imagine this in 3D. And so we introduce gamma star, which we choose as the one skeleton graph of the cell decomposition of the spatial manifold. So we have this decomposition with the one skeleton, which is gamma star. So here it's the graph with a thick red lines. And so once we have this decomposition and with this one skeleton graph, so on this decomposition, this is the decomposition of the spatial hypersurface. So the continuous fields on the continuous phase space of gravity, they live on this decomposition. So the connection and the electric field. And once we have this decomposition with this one skeleton graph, we can introduce the dual graph to this one skeleton graph. And the dual graph is defined as usual by placing vertices of this dual graph inside of the three cells of the decomposition and edges of this dual graph intersecting only one time the two cells of the decomposition. And we're going to see that the discrete data, in fact, the discrete spinetric data live on this dual graph. So this dual graph gamma is going to be really the support for our discrete spinetric phase space. Next slide. And so the trick to get to this, behind this construction, to relate this continuous to discrete data, is to construct a symplectic reduction of the continuous phase space, P, with respect to two specific constraints. So the first constraint that we consider is the constraint that will impose for us flatness of the connection outside of the bones of the cell decomposition, so outside of the dual graph or the graph gamma star. So gamma star is the one skeleton of the decomposition. And so this flatness constraint is generated for us by this smeared constraint, so f of phi, so which is a smearing of the curvature f of a with a Lie algebra valued one form phi. And we choose, in fact, this Lie algebra valued one form phi such that it's vanishing on gamma star. So if this phi is vanishing on gamma star, this constraint f is going to impose for us flatness of the connection everywhere outside of gamma star, which is what we want. And so then again, by Poisson bracket with the phase space variables, we can compute the action of this constraint on the variables. So on A, there is no action because this constraint depends only on A, so it's commuting with itself. So no transformation on A. And on the electric field, this flatness constraint generates a shift symmetry, so a shift transformation, which is given by the covariant derivative of this Lie algebra valued one form. And this, I should specify, is in fact the topological gauge symmetry of BF theory. What we're going to do is take the configuration on the phase space of gravity and impose that we have this topological symmetry, this topological condition, in fact, everywhere outside of the bones of the cell decomposition. And then next slide, so still slide 15. So the next constraint that we're going to use for the symplectic reduction is the constraint that imposes for us Gauss law everywhere outside of the vertices of the graph gamma. Remember that the vertices of the graph gamma are dual to the three cells of the decomposition of the spatial manifold. And this Gauss law is generated for us by this smeared Gauss constraint. So now it's smeared with a Lie algebra valued zero form, so a function. And we choose this Lie algebra function such that it's vanishing on the vertices of the graph. So this is imposing for us the Gauss law outside of the vertices of the graph. And then again, by computing the Poisson bracket with the phase-space variables, I can see what the infinitesimal transformation on the basic phase-space variable is. So next slide, please. So slide 16. So now what we want to do, this construction, is to construct this this new phase space, so P tilde. And this phase space is defined as the symplectic reduction of the full phase space of continuous gravity. So with respect to these two gauge transformations, with these two constraints. And so again, we have to do this in two steps. So the first step, so this is what we mean by this double quotient. And so the first step is to characterize the constraint surface. And so the constraint surface C is characterized by all the set of data in the continuous phase space of gravity, so all the connection and the electric fields, such that the connection is vanishing, the curvature of the connection is vanishing outside of the one skeleton gamma star, and such that the electric field satisfies the Gauss law outside of the vertices V gamma of the dual graph gamma. So once we have this constraint surface, we have to divide again by the residual action of the gauge transformation on this constraint surface. And so our claim, what we're going to show, is that the orbit space, P tilde, is in fact finite dimensional. And the claim is that this is the continuous analog of the discrete spinetric phase space P gamma. So the first step is to construct now the explicit parameterization of this new phase space P tilde. So next slide, please. So slide 17. So the strategy to do so is to solve the curvature in the Gauss constraint inside of each individual three-cell CV. So now I choose these three-cell CV, which are labeled by the vertex, so at the center of the cell. So these are the vertices of the graph gamma. And once we have a solution on all the individual cells, we can glue the solution together and see what the consistency of this gluing is and what the structure that arises is. So next slide. So there is in fact an order in this construction, because when we impose these two constraints, we have to impose them in a specific order. So the first constraint to solve is to solve the curvature constraint. And so inside of a cell CV, the curvature constraint can be solved by considering the following SU2 group elements, so AV of X. So this group element is labeled by the vertex dual to the three cell. And this AV of X is defined as the parallel transport of the connection A from the vertex at the center, from a point X on the boundary of this cell to the center of the cell, to the vertex. And with this element, we can define a flat connection, so in the following way. So the flat connection is as usual, the flat connection is zero up to gauge, and the gauge, this gauge element, in fact, is A of X, and it's AV of X, dAV of X minus 1. And so because this is a flat connection, so the integration which defines this group element does not depend on the path, because precisely this is a flat connection. So this SU2 group element is for us the solution of the curvature constraint inside of all the cells. Next slide, please. So now once we have this solution for the curvature constraint, we can solve the Gauss constraint and see what happens. And so we want to solve the Gauss constraint outside of the vertices V of the graph gamma. And now to do so, we can rewrite, in fact, the Gauss law, the covariant derivative of the electric field, but now using our flat connection. So we write this dE plus commutator between the connection and the electric field using this flat connection. And then by just rearranging the terms of this expression, we can see that if we introduce a Lie algebra valued close to form, XV, which is defined as AV minus 1 EAV, is a Lie algebra valued close to form. So the requirement, in fact, that the E field satisfies the Gauss law is equivalent precisely to requiring that XV is a Lie algebra valued close to form. So just using this formula. So now that we have this solution, so this means that the solution for us to the curvature in the Gauss constraint is given by an SU2 group element AV of X and a Lie algebra valued close to form XV. So living inside of each cell V, CV. And now that we have these solutions, instead of each of the cells, we can glue the solutions together and see what happens when we glue consistently the solutions together. This is on the next slide, slide 19. And so on slide 19, I imagine now that I have two neighboring cells, so a cell C1 and a cell C2. And so the cell C1 is dual to the vertex V1, the cell C2 is dual to the vertex V2. And on each of these cells, I have a group element A1 of X and A2 of X, which is for me a solution to the curvature constraint. And I have also the algebra valued close to form X1 of X and X2 of little x. And now, in fact, so this on the next slide now. So the next slide is the gluing condition, in fact. So if I want to glue in a consistent way these solutions together, so if I require the continuity of these solutions across the phase, this amounts to requiring that there exists an SU2 group element, HE, which acts for me as a transition element, in fact. So the element, the solution to the curvature constraint, so A1 of X in the cell C1, is related to the curvature, to the solution, sorry, of the curvature constraint A2 of X in the cell C2 by this first relation, so by A2 of X equals A1 of X HE. And in a similar way, the two solutions to the Gauss constraint, so this Lie algebra valued close to form, X2 and X1, are related to each other from one cell to the other by just a rotation with this SU2 group element. And so we see from the first relation, relating the solution to the curvature constraint, that this transition element HE is in fact the holonomy of the flat connection. So going from the center of one cell to the center of the other cell, and going through the boundary of these cells, the boundary that is connecting these two cells. So this tells us that the constraint space, C, so once we glue all the solutions together, is spanned by the data AV, XV, and HE. So this, for me, is solving the curvature constraints, the Gauss constraints, and then we also have to provide these transition elements. And now once we have this constraint surface C, we have to divide by the residual action of the gauge group F and G. Because now on this constraint surface, we have the action of this gauge transformation on these variables. And we have to factor out this information. This is done on the next slide, slide 21. And so on slide 21, we can ask, so what we saw earlier is that the constraints, the curvature constraint F and the Gauss constraint G, they act on the continuous variables. So on the continuous collection A of X and on the continuous electric field E of X. And now we can see what is this action at the level of the discrete data. So on the group elements AV and on the Lie algebra elements XV. And so if I choose, the first thing to say is that as we saw earlier, since the curvature constraint depends only on the connection, it has no action in fact on the connection. And so the only action on the connection is the action of SU2 gauge transformation. And if we choose the SU2 group element such that it's the identity at the vertices of the graph, just by definition of the group element AV of X, we see that the finite action of SU2 gauge transformation is just given by this left multiplication. So AV of X becomes GAV of X. And then at the level of the of this Lie algebra close to form XV of X, so we have an action of the SU2 gauge transformation, which I have not written here. It would just be a conjugation by the group element G. And also what is important for us is that we have this shift of the X field by the external derivative of AV minus 1 phi AV, where phi is this Lie algebra valued one form, which is vanishing on the graph gamma star. So now, next slide. What I want to do is to go to a sort of observable space and construct the observables that are invariant under this gauge transformation, so F and G. with its flatness constraints and this Gauss constraint. And we can see that the observables that are invariant under this gauge transformation are precisely given by the holonomy of the flat connection, so along an edge E, which is connecting the vertices at the center of two neighboring cells, and also given by the flux element, so XE. And so now, given my solution, in fact, to the curvature constraint and to the Gauss constraint, I can compute explicitly the holonomy and the flux. If I compute the holonomy, I get this simple expression in terms of the two group elements living at the two neighboring cells, so ASE and ATE. And what is most interesting is that if I compute the flux element now, so with my flat connection, I can see that the flux element XE is just given by the integral over the phase FE of this Lie algebra valued close to form XV. And so this is nice because we can use this to rewrite the continuous Gauss law. So in terms of this solution to the flatness and Gauss constraint. And we see that the continuous Gauss law becomes simply equivalent to the requirement that all the fluxes XE which are arriving at the vertex at the center of a cell add up to zero, in fact. So this is JV, and so this is for us the discrete generator of the SU2 gauge transformations. This is the discrete analog of the continuous Gauss law. So next slide. So slide 22. Now what we want to show, once we have this this map, so what we have described is that we have a map from continuous to discrete data. And so this map, we can write it with this bracket, because this map, in fact, we see that because we choose observables, so holonomies and fluxes, which are invariant under gauge transformation, generated by this flatness constraint and this Gauss constraint, in fact, two configurations at the continuous level, so the continuous phase space, P tilde, which are related by such a gauge transformation, are mapped to the same discrete data. This is why we can write this map, in fact, as a sort of an equivalence class of maps. So what we're going to show is that this map is, in fact, a Poisson map, so it's preserving the symplectic structure for us, and also is diffeomorphism invariant under certain conditions, so some very specific diffeomorphisms. And so most importantly, so this is the key message here, is that this map from continuous to discrete data can be inverted to reconstruct continuous geometries. So once we specify the discrete data, the holonomies and the fluxes, starting from this, we can reconstruct a point in the continuous phase space, so a connection and an electric field. Yeah, an equivalence class. So again, these continuous geometries are between brackets because with discrete data, we're going to see that these discrete data, they label not a unique continuous geometry, but an equivalence class of continuous geometries. So now we're going to follow these three points. So next slide is the first point. So first point is to show the equivalence of the symplectic structures. And so to do so, so there are some details here, but there are really not, we can go skip this quickly. And so the idea is to start with the symplectic potential of first order gravity on the spatial hypersurface, so integrated over sigma. And they use the decomposition of sigma in terms of our cell decomposition, delta. And we can evaluate now the electric field in this symplectic potential and the connection A on the configurations on the constraint surface. Now we evaluate the symplectic potentials not on any electric field and any connection, but on the gauge invariant electric field and flat connections. So this is done simply by using our expression for the flat connection and the gauge invariant electric field. And once we play this game, we rearrange all the terms and we see that this symplectic potential is in fact equal to the symplectic potential on the spinetric phase space. So it's equivalent to the sum over all the edges of this trace of the flux element and DHE, HE minus 1. This shows that the symplectic reduction P tilde of the continuous phase space of gravity that we have constructed is indeed finite dimensional and isomorphic, so in terms of symplectic structure, to the spinetric phase space P gamma. And now next slide, please. So next slide is to study a particular kind of diffeomorphism invariance of this map. And so, in fact, this particular map sorry, it's particular diffeomorphism is a diffeomorphism phi naught, which we choose to be connected to the identity and preserving the gas, the graph gamma star, so the one skeleton of the cell decomposition, and preserving also the vertices of the graph gamma. And so to show, in fact, that the map from continuous to discrete data is invariant under this diffeomorphism, we can use a very nice feature, which is the unshared equivalence between diffeomorphisms and gauge transformations. And in fact, we know that this is true for topological theories. And if you think of what we have done so far, is that we have constructed, in some sense, a piecewise topological theory, because now our theory is topological everywhere outside of the bones gamma star. The connection is flat everywhere outside of gamma star. And so, in fact, if we consider diffeomorphisms which do not move gamma star and the vertices of gamma, in fact, it's only on gamma star and the vertices of gamma that all the, if you want, the important information is encoded. So it's in some sense natural that if you consider a diffeomorphism that moves only the inside of the cell and not the one skeleton gamma star and the vertices, and that also does not distort the phase too much, this is why we choose diffeomorphism that is connected to the identity, such diffeomorphisms are going to preserve this map for us. And so to see that, we can write the action of a diffeomorphism, which is given by the lead derivative along a vector field psi of the connection and the electric field, which is given by these two expressions. And so now, if you go to the next slide, slide 25, I've added some material. And in fact, so to go from slide 24 to 25, we have used the fact that on the constraint surface C, we can get rid of some terms in this Lie derivative, because we know that on the constraint surface C, the curvature vanishes outside of gamma star. So on the first Lie derivative, we can remove the curvature. And we also know that on the constraint surface C, E satisfies the Gauss law. So the term dA of E vanishes outside of gamma star. So on the second Lie derivative, we can remove the first term. And what we end up with is, in fact, just the gauge transformation, so this topological gauge transformation generated by the curvature constraint, and SU2 gauge transformation generated by the Gauss constraint. And so this shows that on shell, the diffeomorphisms, so this Lie derivative along the vector field psi, is given just by the sum of two gauge transformations, but with field-dependent parameters. So now the parameters of these gauge transformations are the interior product between the vector field and the E field, and the interior product between the vector field and the connection. So next slide. Now we get to maybe the most important points of this construction. So now it's the, yeah, it's another section. Now it's the gauge choices, so slide 26. And so we see that at the continuous level, we have a gauge equivalence class of gauge-related configurations. So this means that, again, if we take a point in the phase space, in the continuous phase space of gravity, so a connection and an electric field, we know how the SU2 gauge transformation acts. This is the action of little g on A, and the conjugation of the electric field with g minus 1. And we know also how the topological symmetry acts on the E field. So remember that this topological gauge symmetry acts only on the E field and not on the connection. And so two gauge-related configurations at the continuous level are mapped to the same discrete data. So this means that if now we think about inverting this map, so if we think about starting from discrete data, so discrete holonomies and fluxes living on the spinetric phase space, and now if we want to construct a point at the continuous level, we're going to end up not on one specific configuration, but on an entire equivalence class of gauge-related configurations. And so the question we ask, it's a game we can play, is can we identify some very specific representative choices of these gauge-related configurations? And it turns out that two very nice choices, or two very nice elements of these gauge-related configurations are what we can call the loop quantum gravity gauge and the spin-form gauge. So here we have used a notation with this vacuum vector, but this is only classical. This is not a quantum thing, this is purely classical. But by this we mean that The loop quantum gravity gauge, what is this gauge? So it's a gauge in which E on this vacuum state equals zero. So this means that the E field is in some sense singular outside of the graph gamma. And we know that this is the geometrical interpretation of loop quantum gravity, because in LQG, we know that excitations of the gravitational field have support on these one-dimensional links, and the vacuum state, so the state of no geometry, is just the state in which we have no links. So if I have no link, so the vacuum state, I have no electric field, so no intrinsic geometry. So this is the singular gauge. And the sort of dual picture to this is the spin foam gauge. And so the spin foam gauge is a gauge in which so we have a flat connection, so the curvature of the connection is zero, but the electric field is not singular. In fact, the electric field in the spin foam gauge is a flat outside of the bounds, so outside of the graph gamma star. This corresponds to the geometrical picture of spin foams in which we glue flat simplices together, so a flat tetrahedron, but in which inside the E field is not singular. So at first it seems to be a sort of like an incompatibility with this, between these two pictures. But we're going to see that, I mean, we can already announce this now, that these two pictures, these two interpretations, are in fact just two representatives in the same equivalence class of continuous geometries. So in fact, these are two equivalent points related by gauge transformation that we can construct at a continuous level starting from the exact same discrete data. So next slide, please, slide 27. So the first gauge we want to talk about is the singular gauge, the LQG gauge. And so in this singular gauge, so it's nice because we can have an explicit construction for the singular electric field. And so remember that the idea now is to construct the continuous field, the continuous connection and electric field. So here mostly we are interested in the electric field in terms of the discrete data. And so this can be done explicitly now. We can, once we have fixed the holonomies and the fluxes, so the elements H and X, we can reconstruct a singular electric field. So we have written here two expressions just to show that on the second expression, because of this delta E of X, we see that the E field defined in such a way is singular, in the sense that it's vanishing outside of the edge of the graph. And with the first expression, so with this dA, this covariant derivative, we see that this E field satisfies the Gauss law. And so also by construction in some sense, we see that this E field satisfies the condition that we called gauge choice, in the sense that if now we do the inverse map again, so now we, starting from discrete data, we have constructed a continuous field, so a continuous singular electric field. And now if we go again from this continuous field to discrete data, so with the map I, we end up, of course, again on the discrete data, some discrete flux element. This is what we call the condition for this this gauge choice. It's just a name. Okay. So slide 28, next slide. So the second gauge that is important is the flat gauge, or the spin foam gauge. And so what we call the flat gauge is a gauge in which inside of each cell of sigma without gamma star, so in the interior of the cells of the cell decomposition of the spatial manifold, we define a flat geometry. And so we can see that the flat geometry is in fact characterized by a flat connection A and a frame field little e, which satisfies dA of E equals zero, so such that the covariant derivative of this frame field is zero. And why does this define a flat geometry inside of the cells? Simply because if we compute the covariant derivative with respect to the Ashtekar-Barbero connection of the electric field, so we have two contributions, because the Ashtekar-Barbero connection is the sum of the spin connection plus gamma times the extrinsic curvature. So the contribution coming from the spin connection is equal to zero, because the spin connection is the one which is compatible with the frame field. And then we end up with the fact that the covariant derivative of E is equal to gamma commutator between the extrinsic curvature and the frame field. And so we see that if the frame field E is invertible, and if it also satisfies the torsion-free condition, so dA of E equals zero, we have that the extrinsic curvature K is vanishing. And so if strangely curvature K is vanishing, we have that the Ashtekar-Barbera connection A is equal only to the spin connection. And so if the connection, the Ashtekar connection A is flat, it means that the metric determined by the frame field defines a flat connection as well. So a flat metric flat connection. So this is the sense in which we claim that if we have inside of a cell a flat connection A and a frame field which satisfies the torsion-free connection, we have a metric flat geometry. So next slide, please. So slide 28. So the thing is that what we have access to is the E field, in fact. And so at the continuous level, once we construct from the discrete data the continuous data, so a continuous E field, we see that we can use the gauge freedom on the E field to map the E field to another E field, so which is E plus this shift, this topological symmetry, so this shift dA of phi. But the idea is to use this gauge freedom at the continuous level to find another electric field which comes from a frame field which is torsion free. Because in fact, if we start with an arbitrary electric field at a continuous level, even if this continuous electric field satisfies the Gauss law, nothing tells us that this electric field comes from a frame field, so a little e, which is torsion free. And so the idea is just to show that we can always use a gauge transformation, so of this kind, generated by the flatness constraint F, which does this shift on the electric field, such that the electric field comes from a frame field which is torsion free. So this tells us, in fact, that we can always, at the continuous level, use the gauge transformation generated by the curvature constraint to get to the flat spin foam gauge. So to reach the gauge in which so the connection is flat, this has not changed, but in which, most importantly, the frame field is torsion-free. And so in fact, this tells us something else. This tells us that if we have now a point in the phase space of continuous gravity such that the connection is flat, but its curvature is zero, and also the frame field satisfies dA of B equals zero, this is in fact the cotangent bundle to the modular space of flat connection, modular gauge transformation. This tells us that we can see, in fact, P gamma, in some sense, as the space of piecewise metric flat geometries on the manifold sigma without the bound gamma star, because on the bound gamma star the connection is not flat. And so this interpretation of the spinetric phase space P gamma in terms of the contingent bundle to the modular space of flat connections outside of the bound gamma star is something that was already studied in the past by Eugenio Bianchi. So here we reached a similar conclusion, and this corresponds to the flat spin foam gauge. Now the next slide, slide 29. So we can say something else about the flat spin foam gauge. And in fact, in the flat spin foam gauge, we see that if we can reach a gauge in which we have a flat frame field, a frame field which is torsion-free, we can use again the same trick as we used before for the electric field and write really the covariant derivative of the frame field in terms of the flat connection, which is defined by this group element AV of X. And if we do so, we just see that inside of each cell CV, we can write the frame field EV of X in terms of the derivative of a flat coordinate, so of these elements XV of X. So this XV is a set of flat coordinates inside of the cell. And so now if we compute the flux element in terms of this little frame field, so here again we just use the definition of the flux element, so with this additional holonomy, this additional parallel transport, and then we replace the capital E field, the electric field, by its expression, so epsilon AJK EJ wedge EK. We can express the flux field, the flux element, as the integral of the wedge product of these two flat coordinates, so DXJ wedge DXK. And so now we see that, so on next slide, slide 29, we see that now if we force the faces to be flat, so inside of one cell CV that I consider, I can choose now that the geometry of the faces and the edges that are the boundary of this cell, I can choose this to be flat. And if I choose this to be flat, the expression for the flux element just becomes, so across the face, dual to the edge E, just becomes in fact the area of the face, so JE, times the normal of the face. And this tells us something interesting, because so if I have such a configuration, so this is in fact, this is the map in fact which defines a twisted geometry, but here I have an additional condition, is that these configurations are already satisfying the green condition, because they are already satisfying the shape matching, in the sense that all the cells are already matching, they're already glued together. So this tells me that if I see LQG in the flat spin foam gauge as piecewise flat geometries, what is the condition to go from an LQG geometry to a Reggie geometry? And this condition is to impose that the cells are not piecewise flat, are not gluing flat cells, I'm not considering a piecewise flat geometry, but I'm considering a piecewise linear flat geometry. So I impose that all the cells that I glue together are really linear, in the sense that the faces are flat and the edges are flat too. So this explains something that we knew already before, but that we know that the LQG phase space is bigger than the phase space of Reggie geometries. And we can see this in terms of we can interpret this in terms of what happens to the extrinsic curvature, because in Reggie geometry, if we impose this flatness of the cell, this means that we can only have a component of the extrinsic curvature parallel to the edge E, in fact. So this is the only element, the only component of the curvature that we have access to. But in loop quantum gravity, the geometrical picture is that if we relax this this condition, so the condition that we have really flat cells glued together, so flat in the sense that the faces are flat and the edges are straight, then we can have access to more components of the extrinsic curvature. So in the sense, there is more data encoded in this LQG geometry. And so now the last point, so next slide please, so slide 30. So this last point is about some notion of cylindrical consistency. So maybe this is not the usual cylindrical consistency that we're used to, but it's a criterion to see what happens with the operators that we can work with. And so the question we can ask now is what happens, so what is the relationship between an operator O living at the continuous level, so on the continuous phase space, so living on the phase space P, what is the relationship between this operator at the continuous level with an operator defined on a graph, with an operator O gamma living on a spinetric phase space. And so we can use the definition of cylindrical consistency, and we can say that a discrete operator O gamma is a cylindrically consistent with the continuous operator. So a collection, because this is on each graph, but so a collection of discrete operators, so for the graph, are cylindrically consistent if we take the continuous operator and restrict it to the constraint surface. This is this O restricted to the constraint surface, so restricted to configurations which satisfy a flatness of the connection and gauge invariant electric field. We say that there is cylindrical consistency if the restriction of this operator is equivalent to the operator on the graph, in fact. So this we can take as a definition of what it means to be cylindrically consistent. And so we see that because of the construction that we have described, we can say that an operator O defined at the continuous level is cylindrically consistent if and only if its restriction to the constraint surface is invariant under the gauge transformation S cross G. So under this transformation generated by the flatness constraint and the Gauss constraint. And this is the case because what we have shown is that the holonomies and the fluxes are the observables, are the quantities that are invariant under this gauge transformation, under F and G. So the question we want to ask is under which condition we can take a continuous operator and write it in terms of a collection of discrete operators living on graphs, and the data that we have access to when we work with graphs are the holonomies and the fluxes. So the question is under which condition I can take a continuous operator and write it as a set of discrete operators defined in terms of anomalies and fluxes. And so on the next slide, it's just a little example. So slide 30. And so this example is with the area operator. So if we think about the continuous area operator, which is the integral over the surface of the square root of the of this product of the electric field, this is the continuous area operator. Then we can think of the area operator that we have in LQG. So this ALQG, which measures the area of a surface S. So it's given as the sum over these edges of the square root of this product of the flux field. And so now we can go back to our definition and see if the continuous area operator is cylindrically consistent. And we can see that just with our definition, the continuous area operator is not cylindrically consistent, because the E field is not invariant. So even if we restrict the E field to be on the constraint surface, even if we restrict the E field to be Gauss invariant, so SU2 invariant, satisfies the Gauss law, E by itself is not invariant, or square root of E or integral of square root of E is not invariant by itself under the shift symmetry, so under the symmetry generated by the flatness constraint. So this means that the LQG area operator is not a restriction to the constraint surface of the continuous area operator. But the way out of this, I don't know if we can call this a problem, but the way out of this observation is that in LQG, the geometric operators are the continuous operators, but written in a specific gauge. And they're the continuous operators written in the singular gauge. Because now if we go to the singular gauge, we know that in the singular gauge, we have an electric field E, which can be written, so with the expression that we gave before, in terms of the flux field. And then this operator in the singular gauge is invariant under the transformation F cross G. But it means that this is the reason, in fact, for which the LQG operator can be written solely in terms of the fluxes. So once we write it on a graph. And so this means that if we think of the geometric operators as continuous operators but written in a specific gauge, this means that we can take any continuous operator and play the game of writing it in different gauges. And this is what happens, in fact, because we know that, for example, for the volume operator, we have different expressions of the volume operator. So we have the usual Rovelli-Smolin and Ashchakar-Lewandowski volume operator of LQG. So this would be the singular gauge. And we also have, I think, a volume operator, which is defined in the spin foam gauge. So that's the volume of a flat polyhedron. So we can ask the question of what happens to the other geometric operators in the other gauges. This is just a little clarification of the fact that we can see these operators as continuous operators, but written in specific gauges. And this, again, is the main message of this construction. The message is that if we have a collection of discrete operators which are written in terms of holonomies and fluxes, what we have shown by this construction is that the holonomies and the fluxes, we don't have to see this as discrete data, as a labeling of discrete information, but we can see this really as a real point in the continuous phase space of gravity, so as a real, genuine, continuous data. And then because we have this freedom at the continuous level between gauge-related configurations, then it's just a matter of a choice of gauge, in fact, in which gauge I choose to work. So for example, the piecewise flat gauge, so the spin foam gauge, is just a choice of gauge at the continuous level, which is on the same footage as the singular LQG gauge. So now the last slide, so 31, the conclusions. So what we have shown is that we have given parametrization of the discrete LQG phase space, P gamma, on a graph, so which is defined by the discrete data, which are the holonomies and the fluxes, in terms of continuous geometries on P tilde, which is the symplectic reduction of the continuous phase space of gravity with respect to the two constraints, which are the flatness constraint and the Gauss constraint. And so this was important because this showed that the discrete data, the holonomies and the fluxes, they label, in fact, an equivalence class of continuous geometries. And so, in fact, in particular, this clarifies the relationship between the geometrical interpretation of LQG, spin foams, and Reggie geometry, And also this enables us to see the geometric operators in LQG as gauge fixed operators. And now, so as we said earlier, a question that we can ask is what about the other geometric operators in the other gauges? We can also study the case of non-vanishing cosmological constants, because now it's interesting because with this construction we can, so starting from the phase space structure at the continuous level, now we can imagine starting from the phase space of a 4D gravity with a cosmological constant. And what we have shown is how to map by a specific symplectic reduction this continuous phase space to what we are used to working with at a discrete level. So we can try to play the same game in the case of a non-vanishing cosmological constant and see what the discrete symplectic structure should be. And so the last point, which is probably the most important point, is that now we can ask the question if we can find at the classical level a formulation of the dynamics of classical GR in terms of the holonomies and the fluxes. And why this is a relevant question now, because with this construction we see that we can see the data on the spinetric phase space not now as just discrete data, but as genuine continuous data, so living on the continuous phase space of gravity. Now we can evolve this data with the continuous equations of GR, with the continuous Einstein equations, and see what happens when we do this evolution, in fact. Because we see that if we start with a kinematical state, so with a spinetric state, this state, which we can see either as a collection of discrete data, so holonomies and fluxes, we can map this to the continuous level, so to really a point in the continuous phase space of gravity, so a continuous configuration, evolve this with the continuous Einstein equations, and see what happens. See if we stay, if we go into another point in this equivalence class of continuous configurations, or if we go out of this equivalence class, if we lose, in fact, this map, if we go outside of this framework. This is a question which is, in fact, the classical analog of what we try to do in loop quantum gravity or in spin-flow models, because the picture that we have usually is that we work on a truncation of the full theory, because this is what makes everything finite, in fact, is that we work on a truncation, so on finite dimensional Hilbert spaces. So the question is that if we do such a truncation at the quantum level, what happens with the classical analog? So we can try to do the same thing, play the same game at the classical level. Another question is just whether this can be done at the classical level or it can't be done. This is what maybe has to be answered now. And final slide. Thank you.
Please ask questions.
Questions?
Any questions?
Hi, this is Jurek again. Do you consider just a single graph and some plaquettes assigned to edges, or do you consider you have chance to consider a large family of graphs and surfaces?
So this particular construction was done on a fixed graph, but then the key message is that we can see the continuous theory as just the collection of when we put back together all possible graphs, in fact. So just as what we do at the quantum level, this has an analog at the classical level. This is what is shown here, is that once we take this projective limit over all the graphs, we reconstruct the continuous at the classical theory, the full theory, just by taking all possible graphs. So yeah, in the end, we can take all possible graphs. But in the construction, we had a fixed graph all the time.
Okay, so given a graph and those XE variables, if I add more edges, those new edges are going to intersect the two surfaces. Or make them to somehow avoid those two surfaces.
I would say that it depends how you add the new edges, because If you add them in a way that is consistent with this this algorithm in some sense, the question is whether there is a way to do so. There is a way to consistently have this graph changing, like add edges, and we don't want, by doing this, we don't want to spoil the entire construction. And to
this is Laurent, maybe to answer that question. In the same way that, you know, when you add edges at the quantum level, you have one Hilbert space which is included into the other. Let's say if one graph is bigger than the other. Then here you have the same construction, that there's a natural notion of inclusion of Poisson manifold, which is that one guy is in fact the quotient, the Simplicity quotient of the other. So you're going to have the same, this analogous notion of a phase space is smaller than the other one if the two graphs are, you know, related to each other. Does that answer your question?
So as far as the graphs are concerned, it's obvious that it will work the same. I'm concerned about those two surfaces, how natural it is that that we are not allowed to intersect a two surface with more than one edge.
It doesn't really matter, because as he showed, at the end of the day, this information about where the two surface is just contained into the gauge equivalent. So that's part of the proof that, in fact, the exact location of these two surfaces is a pure gauge. Except for the location of the boundary of the two surface, which is this dual graph gamma star.
So actually, this dual graph is what is a dual graph? So I know what is a dual graph in case of graph embedded in a two surface, but in three dimensions or for an abstract graph, what is a dual graph?
So the dual graph is the following: is that you have to imagine that start from a graph gamma. So it's slide 14. If you start from a graph gamma, you can imagine that each graph gamma is dual to a three cell. Okay? Each vertex of the graph gamma is dual to a three-dimensional cell. Okay? And then you can imagine, so doing that, you can construct what's called a cellular decomposition, which is adapted to the graph gamma by gluing these three cells together. Is that clear?
Okay.
Mm-hmm. Okay. So once you have a cellular decomposition, the cellular decomposition therefore is such that each face of the cellular decomposition is dual to the edge of the graph gamma, right?
Mm-hmm.
And then each three cell of this cellular decomposition is dual to a vertex of gamma. So once you choose a cellular decomposition adapted to the graph gamma. So if I give you a graph gamma, there's, you know, I can choose a cellular decomposition adapted to the graph gamma. And this is usually what people think of when they say a four-valent vertex is dual to a tetrahedra glued together, right?
Mm-hmm.
So now the thing is that if I have a graph gamma and a cellular decomposition, then I can define the dual graph to be the one skeleton of this cellular decomposition. And this dual graph is going to be such that every face of this dual graph is going to encircle an edge of gamma, they're going to be dual in the same way that you have a duality in two dimensions. Does that clarify?
I see. So this notion is defined only for some graphs, probably not defined for a general graph.
Well, it's defined for a general graph. For any graph, you can define, you know, a notion of a dual graph. So it's defined for every graph. It's defined for every graph. So the data is that you choose a graph gamma and its dual gamma star, and essentially a graph and its dual are that one is always encircling the other, right? It's that one graph, once you have a graph gamma and it's dual, they're on the same footing. It's like you have a pair of graphs which are dual to each other. This is the data you need to have. So it means that in order for this construction to be valid, it's not only that you need to know the embedding of gamma, but you need to know the embedding of this dual graph gamma star. And once you have these two things which are dual to each other, you can start the construction. Does that clarify?
Well, okay, thank you.
Are there any other questions?
More questions?
If there are no more questions, let us thank the speaker again.